Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been an historic Supreme Court term, marked by the death of legendary conservative Justice Antonin Scalia and by a divided eight-person bench. Then, at the end of the term, a series of big rulings on immigration, affirmative action. Yesterday, what's been called the most significant abortion decision in a generation. This hour on Point, a look back at the major moments of the latest Supreme Court term. You can join us on air or online. What did you make of the court's decision on abortion, on political corruption? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me this hour from New York City, Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, co-host of The Slate Political Gabfest, and fellow at Yale Law School. Emily Bazelon, great to have you again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And from Nashville, Tennessee, Brian Fitzpatrick, professor of law at Vanderbilt University Law School. He clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia. Brian Fitzpatrick, welcome to you.
My pleasure.
Emily, the Texas abortion case is being called the most important decision on this issue in a generation. Remind us, what was at stake here?
What was at stake here were restrictions to abortion that Texas passed in 2013. They were regulations that had the effect of causing many abortion clinics in Texas to close. One of the regulations required doctors to get admitting privileges at a local hospital, which sounds totally reasonable, except a lot of doctors couldn't get those privileges. And the other set of regulations required abortion clinics to outfit themselves like an ambulatory surgical center, an expensive and often cumbersome process, which the Supreme Court found was not necessary to protect the health of women who get abortions.
Brian, your reaction to the court's decision in the Texas abortion case?
Well, you know, I think as in many areas of the law where there is really no grounding for the Supreme Court's jurisprudence besides the predilections of the various justices, it's very hard to predict what was going to happen beforehand because we didn't know how Justice Kennedy was going to feel this year about abortion. And so I was not terribly surprised, but I also wasn't terribly confident that the case would come out the way it did. But Kennedy decided this year that he wanted to facilitate abortion rights. And so that is how things turned out.
We'll talk about Justice Kennedy being the swing vote here. Let me play first this Wendy Davis, former Democratic Texas state senator who rose to prominence in 2013 for an 11-hour filibuster that temporarily blocked this Texas abortion law from taking effect. She spoke with CNN yesterday about her reaction to the case.
We were absolutely overjoyed because the court recognized that this law was a sham, that the arguments that somehow this was going to protect women's health was absolutely disingenuous. They saw right through it.
And here's Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life of America, speaking to reporters outside the Supreme Court after the decision on abortion yesterday.
Every single time a woman walks into an abortion facility, she is now going to wonder, is that facility safe? Will she live? Will she survive her abortion?
Emily Bazelon, the argument that this that these provisions would have made abortion safer for women was interesting. The majority of justices did not accept that argument.
Right. And major medical organizations like the American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists also disputed that argument. Abortion is a relatively safe medical procedure. Complications are rare. And when they take place, there is a well-established regimen for women to get the care they need. And so what stuck out here was that abortion was being regulated by the state in a way that was much more constraining than many other riskier outpatient practices. And Justice Breyer, in his majority opinion, made a little list. It includes things like colonoscopies, which tend out to be far riskier in terms of the complication rate than abortion. Mm.
Pick that up, Brian Fitzpatrick. Justice Breyer, in his majority opinion, wrote that the argument that we're just talking about here did not justify the undue burden. I guess that's the key language here, right? The undue burden that the law would have imposed on women's rights to an abortion.
Yes. So in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, the conservative, if you will, moderate conservative plurality in that case laid down this undue burden standard. The state cannot impose an undue burden on access to abortion. But what I find even more significant than the application of that standard here was Justice Breyer and the majority's decision to add a new component to the standard. And that was not only do you look at the burden on the access to abortion now, but you have to weigh it against the benefit of the regulation the state has imposed. And I think that was a very key turn of events here and probably the most significant aspect of the opinion, because Justice Breyer said, we don't see any benefit to these regulations. Therefore, really no burden is going to be justified by them. And so I think that this is a significant addition to the test, and I think it really spells doom for these similar regulations in other states around the country, because even if it doesn't close as many clinics as it did in Texas, or even if people live closer to the clinics that are still open, unlike Texas, because Justice Breyer said there's no benefit to these types of laws, I don't think they can be justified probably in any state.
Here's Amy Hagstrom-Miller. She's founder of the Whole Woman's Health Clinics, the plaintiffs in this case. She reacted to the decision yesterday outside the court.
After years of fighting heartless, anti-choice politicians who would seemingly stop at nothing to put abortion out of reach, I want everybody to understand you don't mess with Texas women.
Emily Bazelon, as Brian says, this case goes well beyond Texas. There are similar abortion laws under consideration in nearly two dozen states. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think Brian is right that this idea of weighing the benefits, the health benefits to women of a law like this against the burden to access it imposes is the most important part of this decision. And it, as Brian said, probably will mean that most of those laws will be struck down. You know, one thing I remembered in listening to Amy Hagstrom-Miller right there is that I visited her clinic a couple of years ago in Texas. It was a clinic in Austin that was about to shut down because it didn't meet the state's requirements, some of which had gone into effect. And when I was touring the clinic, one of the things that struck me was it had been set up with a real eye toward caring for women. So in the recovery room, women had tea. They were lying under fleece blankets. There were, soothing posters on the walls. And Amy and her staff were pointing out that a lot of those components would be gone if Texas's law went into effect, because if you have to outfit like a surgical center, you can't have things like blankets. They're not sterile. So there was a way in which the supposedly beneficial aspects of this law were actually at odds with the standard of care in a lot of places for taking care of women. And I think that the majority recognized that. And Justice Breyer talked a little bit about women deserving individualized attention and emotional support when they seek an abortion. And that was, I think, for a lot of pro-choice advocates, welcome language. It's been a long time since a majority opinion of the Supreme Court has been written in an abortion case by a liberal justice.
Well, let's talk about another justice, Anthony Kennedy. Brian, you brought him up. He sided with the liberal justices in this case. He has refused to overturn Roe v. Wade, but he'll side with liberals on that big question. But he's always sided with conservatives on the regulations, right? The restrictions.
Well, I mean, here he did not side with the conservatives on the regulations. He is very unpredictable, and I hope we'll talk later in the hour maybe about the affirmative action case where he also, I think, was even more unpredictable than he was this time. You know, as one of my friends who clerked for Justice Kennedy says, you're not a swing vote if you never swing. And so he has to swing to the left sometimes, I guess, to keep him in that role as a swing vote. You know, but he's so unpredictable. And I think there's just something unsettling to me about living in a democracy where so many of our public policy questions end up being left up to Justice Kennedy's predilections. I just find it astonishing that we have come to accept a system where one person has so much control over our public policy. And it reminds me of an academic study that was done several years ago where scholars asked 100 law professors of constitutional law to try to predict what the Supreme Court would do in the upcoming term. And law professors were completely unable to predict what either Justice Kennedy or O'Connor were going to do in any given year. And I just think that they continue to prove that they are very hard to understand.
Here's Carrie Severino, Chief Counsel and Policy Director for the Conservative Judicial Crisis Network. She spoke with CBS yesterday and said that the Supreme Court's decision on abortion was clearly based on politics.
This court has been so clear in their political leanings on this issue that I can't imagine an abortion regulation that they would uphold at this point. That's unfortunate.
What do you make of that, Emily Bazelon? Politics here.
I think that's a little silly. I mean, you know, the court has upheld multiple abortion regulations in the past, things like 24-hour waiting limits. There are a lot of restrictions in the states right now banning abortion after 20 weeks. We don't know what the Supreme Court, what Justice Kennedy would say about that. And so while I often share Brian's frustration with Kennedy's enormous power, I think the idea that it was, you know, a given and that the court would strike down any regulation is just not an accurate portrayal of the way in which Kennedy does move back and forth.
Brian, this was a 5-3 vote, five votes here, even without Justice Scalia. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, Scalia's vote would not have mattered here. It would, and I just think that, you know, we've known for some time now, as you noted, that Kennedy has been a supporter of the core, if you will, of Roe v. Wade now for over 20-some years. And I think we've known now for a long time that there is a majority of the Supreme Court that thinks that there's a right to an abortion in the Constitution. And that didn't change with Scalia's death, that there's still five votes for abortion rights being in the Constitution.
How'd that strike you, Emily? Five votes even without Justice Scalia.
Well, I think that Brian's right. I mean, Kennedy tipped his hand in Casey years ago, and he is stuck with that basic idea. The question is, what are the limits? Because the undue burden standard allows for some regulation. And what we've learned here, as we've been saying, is that the benefits have to outweigh the burdens.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the major decisions by the High Court. You're hearing abortion rights activists in Washington cheering yesterday as the word of the decision in the Texas abortion case spread. You can join us this hour. Where does the abortion debate go from here? What about immigration reform? From New York, Emily Bazelon is with me, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, co-host of the Slate Political Gabfest, fellow at Yale Law School, and Brian Fitzpatrick is with me from Nashville, professor of law at Vanderbilt University, formerly a clerk with Justice Antonin Scalia. A lot of talk online about this hour, especially this case. Jeanette says women already have a tough life to live without Republicans limiting their choices. The Supreme Court did good. Carrie says, no, abortion is not a women's health issue. It is a child welfare issue. Birth control is an issue regarding women's health and reproductive rights. Stop confusing the two. And DC says conservatives and liberals both need to stop thinking in absolutes when it comes to abortion. Abortion is an ethical and constitutional quagmire with conflicting interests. Wouldn't it be nice if both sides recognized each other's positions as being held in good faith? So one last point on this, Brian Fitzpatrick, before we move on to the other cases at the court. How does this landmark Texas abortion case fit into the longer history of abortion cases in this country?
Well, I think it's a modest development in favor of abortion rights. As I said, I think the most significant part of the decision is this addition of an inquiry into the benefits that the law provides. And so if the law is not providing a lot of benefits, then the burden that the law can impose cannot be very big at all. And so I think that that will make it easier to challenge abortion restrictions around the country. And as we said, I suspect that the similar restrictions in other states will fall now. One thing if you'll allow me, Jane,
yes.
One thing I did find interesting in the comments that you read from our listeners online is that none of those comments have anything to do with anything that the Constitution says or doesn't say. And I get back to this point that I started with, which is there's really nothing in the Constitution about abortion. And so the discussion about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to have those restrictions, I think that's a very important discussion to have. But it's really not one that has anything to do with constitutional law. It's really a policy question. And I do think that the justices taking this area over have really taken over an area of policy rather than an area of law.
Let's get listener Tina in here from Austin, Texas. Hi, Tina. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi. So I'm with a group called James Due Process, and we provide legal services for pregnant teens in Texas when they want to terminate a pregnancy and can't find a parent or don't want to involve the parent. And while it's a great victory, obviously, yesterday, there are still so many restrictions on women and teens to access abortion care, including a sonogram bill and 20 weeks, and, of course, the most restrictive judicial bypass law that's passed in the country. So while we love it, it's still, we have so much more work to go.
Tina, thank you. Brian Fitzpatrick, do you have comments on those?
Well, yeah, I think that, again, this opens up the door to a lot more challenges to those kinds of restrictions. And, you know, one of the criticisms, and I think a fair criticism, of the undue burden test and now the undue burden versus benefit test that we have is that it is very vague and is going to basically turn on whatever the particular judges who hear the cases think about abortion. There's really no objective way to answer the question whether this benefit is greater than that burden. They're two entirely different items. You can't really put them on the same scale. And so it's really going to be up to the personal views of the judges hearing these cases. And so if you get a liberal judge, I think you're going to get stuff struck down. If you get a conservative judge, you probably won't.
Emily Bazelon, what will happen to the Texas abortion clinics that have already closed? I think they're down to 19 clinics now from around 40, 41. Will those clinics reopen?
Some of them could reopen because the ones that shut down because some of these regulations went into effect. And in particular, the admitting privileges requirement. And so with that lifted, some clinics could reopen. It'll be interesting to see how the landscape changes. You know, the one thing I would add to Brian's comment about how this is a modest development is that from the point of view of major abortion opponent groups, this tactical shift toward pushing for legislation that restricts abortion on the basis of protecting women's health, that has been a major development. The groups clearly have targeted that kind of regulation and restriction as a kind of new wave in the last several years, a new way of restricting abortion. And the end game was to shut down clinics. There are a few states like Mississippi and Alabama and North Dakota, in which, or South Dakota, there are only one or two or three abortion clinics left in the states. And so that really was what was at issue here, this question of restricting access by just ending the practice of having clinics in parts of the country where they're unpopular. And that goes to this foundational question of whether abortion truly is a constitutional right. And the burden that's imposed is really a burden that falls on low-income women, right? Because if you increase travel distances, if you up the cost of having an abortion, those are the women who are really affected. Mm.
Well, more to come on this, certainly. Let's talk now about some of the other important cases that the court decided this term. The case of the former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, who was convicted by a jury of 11 corruption-related felony counts in 2014. Here is Bill Stanley, a Republican Virginia state senator and supporter of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, celebrating Monday's ruling at the Supreme Court, which overturned McDonnell's conviction. He said the former governor displayed bad judgment but did not commit a crime.
When you look at what occurred, and no one denies what occurred, and certainly our Governor McDonnell does not deny it either, there's a difference between, and when I said judgment, good or bad, there's a difference between what may be considered, in hindsight, bad judgment, and what is considered to be a criminal act.
Emily Bazelon, why did the court take up this case in the first place?
The court is concerned that federal prosecutors were overreaching in their use of this federal bribery statute to prosecute the governor of Virginia. And this is in some ways about the difference between the roles that federal and state law play in prosecuting crimes. When the governor took these gifts, Virginia didn't have a law in its statute that simply said you can't accept Rolex watches and super fancy jewelry from one of your constituents, someone who wants something from you. The state has since passed a law like that, and a lot of other states have those laws. So it's wrong to think that the court made it impossible to address this kind of corruption. But what the court did say was that it's not the job of federal prosecutors wielding a law that talks about honest services, a kind of capacious, vague term for the responsibilities of government officials. It's not a law like that that should be used to prosecute the kind of behavior that we saw here.
And so, Brian Fitzpatrick, what are the implications then of this ruling when it comes to charging public officials with corruption? Does it raise the bar for proving that public officials are corrupt?
Absolutely. And it comes in a long line of I think, almost always unanimous or close to unanimous decisions by the court, making it harder to prosecute what I would call white-collar criminals. The Supreme Court has slapped down overzealous prosecutions of white-collar criminals time and time again over the last 6 or 7 years. Back in 2010, there were, I think, 3 cases involving the honest services law. One was against the Enron executive, Jeff Skilling, and there were a couple of others where they reversed or vacated convictions. There was a case, I think it was last year, where prosecutors were trying to use the Sarbanes-Oxley corporate record-keeping law to go after some guy that threw some fish overboard of a ship. I don't know if you remember that case from a year or so ago. And now we have this one. And I think the Supreme Court has really been a friend to white-collar criminals and really held the government to a very careful standard, making sure all the I's are dotted, all the T's crossed, not letting them expand the criminal law into areas that would really implicate broad types of fairly ordinary conduct. You know, I think that was the court's concern here, is that if we take the government's view of this statute, a lot of ordinary political behavior would be subject to the criminal law. And I think the court doesn't want the laws to be interpreted so broadly that prosecutors have so much discretion they can go after anyone they want to.
Let's get Tim in here from Fenton, Missouri. Hi, Tim. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I'm just calling to talk about. I believe it's political corruptness going on in the U.S. right now. And I've got a quote from President Ronald Reagan, who said, "Government is not the solution; government is the problem." And I'm calling to talk about this Senate sit-in about, I believe it's gun control or something. I think it's absolutely ridiculous, Our Republicans and Democrats refuse to elect the Supreme Court Justice, and it's clear that our Senate can't function without that. My son does this when he wants a bottle of milk. He sits there and he whines and he cries, and that's exactly what the Senate's doing now. I understand it. I believe there needs to be a little bit stricter gun laws regarding people that are on the known terrorist watch list and so on and so forth. And I also believe that something needs to be done about illegal immigration. If we let people that aren't being fully scanned or fully looked at close enough into our country, well, we're bound to see more terrorist attacks and bad things happen in the U.S.
Got it, Tim. Thank you very much. Let me turn the Merrick Garland point. Tim brings up this 8-person court and getting a 9th person on there. Does anything that happened with regard to the decisions in this 8-person Supreme Court make it more or less likely, Emily Bazelon, that Merrick Garland will be confirmed in a lame duck session of Congress this year?
I don't think so. I think this question about Merrick Garland's confirmation just really has to do with who wins the presidency. If Hillary Clinton wins, Merrick Garland may start looking pretty good to the Republicans in the Senate, who said, after all, that they wanted to wait for the next election. And obviously, if Donald Trump is the presidential candidate, then, you know, it will be tempting for Republicans to leave it to him to fill this seat. So I think that's really the political calculation we're looking at. And this term was an excellent reminder of how much it matters who sits in that 9th seat and the way in which that person's choice is directly tied to politics.
Let's move on. The other big case from last week was the United States versus Texas at the Supreme Court, the case that took up the issue of whether President Obama had the authority to shield millions of immigrants from deportation. That was a deadlocked 4-4 tie, upholding the decision of the lower court. Brian Fitzpatrick, remind us who was affected by this case.
Well, in this case, there was a very peculiar law, really, in Texas. What Texas was doing with its public universities was it was admitting automatically Any student that graduated in the top 10% or so of their high school class, you could go to any Texas university you wanted to. That ended up filling about 75% of the seats at the University of Texas at Austin. And so they were allowed on to consider other factors for the last 25% of the spots. And one of the factors that the university was considering was skin color. They wanted to change the racial composition of the student body, and so they were considering skin color for those last spots. And a female applicant that was not admitted, Abigail Fisher, filed a lawsuit against the university saying it was unconstitutional, violated the Equal Protection Clause to look at skin color in those spots. And the reason why this was peculiar was because the reason why Texas filled the first 75% of the slots with this automatic procedure that if you got in the top 10% of your high school class, you got in automatically, was because Texas thought that this automatic procedure would produce a lot of racial diversity because the high schools in Texas are very segregated. So if you take the top 10% of each one, you get a lot of racial diversity. And in fact, this plan did produce a lot of racial diversity. And so Abigail Fisher's argument was there's really no reason to consider skin color given that this high school class rank policy is producing so many Latino and African American students. And frankly, I think most of us thought that the Supreme Court was going to hold that Texas couldn't look at skin color. They were getting a lot of diversity through what they call the Texas 10% plan, and there wasn't a lot of need to consider skin color. But I was wrong again. Justice Kennedy swung again to the other side and said that, no, we think it's okay for Texas to look at skin color too. And this one I think was very, very surprising because Kennedy had always been a real skeptic of affirmative action programs, but here he really gave a pretty ringing endorsement, I think, to the use of race.
I did ask initially about immigration, but we did get to affirmative action, which I'll play some sound here after I say I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Here is President Obama responding to the Supreme Court's ruling in the affirmative action case in Texas.
In the affirmative action case, I'm pleased that the Supreme Court upheld the basic notion that diversity is an important value in our society, and that this country should provide a high-quality education to all our young people, regardless of their background.
And here's Todd Gaziano of the Conservative Pacific League Foundation speaking outside the Supreme Court on June 23rd after the decision came down in the affirmative action case.
We will continue to fight for equal protection, and we will be back at the Supreme Court on the day when the Supreme Court issues a correct ruling that upholds all Americans' right to be considered regardless of their race.
Emily Bazelon, in his dissent, Justice Alito, in this affirmative action case, said that this was, quote, affirmative action gone berserk based on offensive and unsupported stereotypes. Talk about the implications of this decision upholding affirmative action practices at the University of Texas.
Well, admissions officials across the country breathed a huge sigh of relief about this case, because if it had gone the other way, it would have looked to them like they have to change their practices, that considering race as a factor in admissions could have been taken off the table in a way that is certainly at odds with how many selective universities think about admissions and affirmative action. You know, I agree with Brian that it is very hard to square Justice Kennedy's opinion in this round of this case, Fisher versus University of Texas, with his opinion 3 years ago when he sounded super skeptical of the way UT was using race in admissions. This time around, he's talking about deferring to university officials. And, you know, there's a complicated and I think questionable history of how the court has set up affirmative action. But if you accept the box they have put themselves in, which is a box that means affirmative action can only be justified in terms of the benefits of educational diversity, nothing about past discrimination, nothing about the country's history of racism. If you accept that box, then if you're going to let affirmative action continue, I don't think you have much choice other than to defer to university officials. So that was a necessary move in the structure that we have here, but it was really surprising to see Kennedy be the justice who made that move.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Supreme Court and actions that have come this term, big rulings on abortion, political corruption, a term that weathered the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, and a big debate over whether his chair should be filled now or after the 2016 election. You can join the conversation. Should the next president fill the seat? Should Merrick Garland get an up or down vote? Can an eight-person court get the job done? My guest this hour, Brian Fitzpatrick, professor of law at Vanderbilt University, Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, and fellow at Yale Law School, co-host of the Slate Political Gabfest. Got a caller in here, wants to talk about the affirmative action ruling. Skylar is in Grove, Oklahoma. Welcome to the program, Skylar. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
Okay, so my comment, or rather my take on the whole diversity question in the universities is, why is it that it's not purely competition-based when they have this notion that you, if you're white, you have less chances because they're looking for more diversity. So why is it that it's not seen in this context that they are purposely being anti-white?
All right, Skylar, thank you. Emily Bazelon, would you take that? Why is this not competition-based?
Well, I think in many ways it is competition-based. Let's remember that most of the slots at UT were going to white students. In fact, when you look at the state's racial composition, the number of Black and Hispanic kids who are of age to go to college, white people were disproportionately represented. Really, I think one way to think about affirmative action is whether in college admissions, schools should try to compensate in some way for the inequities in education in the K through 12 system. Texas, like a lot of states, has very racially segregated high schools and elementary schools. And we know that racial segregation often disadvantages Black and Hispanic students. They wind up at schools that just aren't as good for a variety of reasons. And so one way to think about what the colleges are doing here is trying to compensate in some way for those problems. That may not be the right or the best fix. We would probably be better off with integrated good K through 12 education for everyone. And so you can also think of this as like the cheap way out.
Hmm. Priyanka is on the phone from Austin, Texas with a call on this point. Hi, Priyanka. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a student at the University of Texas at Austin, and I just wanted to point out that even with the top 10% rule that's supposed to increase the amount of diversity already in the university,
mm-hmm.
only 4% of the student population, the undergrad population at UT, is African American. And so I just want to point out that even if we argue that these top 10% rules increase diversity, it's still mostly white and Asian Americans here at the university anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I think we should have these policies of affirmative action that do use race.
Glad you called, Priyanka. Thank you. Here's Sophia in Boston. Welcome to the program. Hi, Sophia.
Hi, Jane. I am an attorney, and I have a ton of friends working both on affirmative action stuff and immigration stuff. And I just had a couple of comments. Firstly, on the affirmative action case.
Okay.
I'm really grateful that they did make the decision that they did. I think it's super important that we maintain programs that encourage diversity. I know it can be kind of problematic, and I'm a white woman myself, so I could sort of see, I suppose, where Abigail Fisher is coming from, but I think it's critically important that at universities where diversity is an issue, that we continue to work to have opportunities for folks of color.
So that's affirmative action. What about other issues? Immigration, for example, at the court?
Sure. So with the immigration, I was, along with a lot of my friends and coworkers, I was pretty heartbroken that they made the decision that they did, that that things are going to stay undecided and that millions of people are going to be in limbo. I think it's really unfair to people who are here, who are undocumented, who are really, have done nothing wrong. They're looking for better opportunities and living here, mm-hmm. abiding mm-hmm. by the laws, other than the fact that they're here without paperwork.
Glad you got us there, Sophia. Thank you so much. Let's turn now to the immigration ruling. Here's Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute, actually speaking to Fox News about the immigration ruling at the Supreme Court, about what he described as President Obama's overreaching.
Maybe if he had, at the very beginning, not ignored the separation of powers and other constitutional provisions throughout his entire tenure in every area, maybe then Congress would trust him and we could have an actual immigration reform.
Brian Fitzpatrick, Sophia mentioned the millions of people in limbo. What happens to all these people affected by this case now?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. So the case just involved a preliminary injunction. And so that is an order that's entered right at the beginning of the case, but it does not end the case. It just means the case goes forward to trial, but the president's program cannot be implemented pending the trial. And so this case is going to continue in the lower courts, and we will see what happens in the lower courts after a trial, and it may come right back up to the Supreme Court when we have nine justices up there. And so it's not the last word. It's just a delay in the president's program, and we don't know what the final outcome is going to be yet.
I want to hear from Ezzy Dominguez, who was born in Mexico. Now she lives with her undocumented husband and their son in Denver. She says she was hoping that President Obama's executive actions on immigration would shield her family from deportation. Speaking to NPR, she reacted to the news of the court's 4-4 tie in this immigration case.
I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm confused. I was looking up to the Supreme Court. You know, them being the Supreme Court, that you will think that they will make the just decision, that they will decide to stand on the side of love with families.
So a 4-4 tie in this immigration case, Emily Bazelon, what might a full court have done differently?
Well, if the full court had Justice Scalia on it, it would surely have, in a more definitive way, said that President Obama's actions to provide deportation relief went too far. If there is a Democratic appointee in that 9th seat, we might see the opposite result, which shows the way in which politics plays into this issue. In terms of the implications for the people who are hoping for deportation relief, what's at stake for them is this ability to plan, right? I mean, we were talking about 3 years of knowing that you could stay in the country, and also work authorization. Being able to work here legally is a big deal for people. And so I think that helps explain the deep disappointment of people like the woman who NPR interviewed.
So to that point of the 4-4 tie in that particular case, I wanted to play some sound from Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Stephen Breyer. They've weighed in on this 8-person court issue, speaking in May at the Fourth Circuit Judicial Conference in West Virginia. Here's Chief Justice Roberts talking about how he and his colleagues find consensus in the court's decisions.
I try to achieve as much consensus as I can. Again, that's not something that I can do on my own. We kind of have to have a commitment as a group to do that. And I don't want to speak for the others, but I think we spend a fair amount of time, I think a little more than others maybe in the past, talking about things, talking them out, you know, which sometimes brings you a little bit closer together.
Brian Fitzpatrick, the Chief Justice there, seemed to be implying that the court is doing more to compromise maybe than it has in the past. Would you agree? I mean, is there an argument to be made that having 8 justices on the bench is not as bad, not as consequential as people have made it out to be?
Well, I don't think it's the end of the world, certainly. There are frankly not that many decisions where a 9th justice would have made a difference. This immigration case is one where it would have, but there aren't that many of those every term. And like I said, this is going to come back in a year or two after we have a trial. So it's not the end of the matter. I do think the Chief Justice is particularly interested, perhaps because of its institutional role as the Chief Justice, in forging consensus. And I think we've seen evidence of attempts to do that this term in Scalia's absence, including the religious freedom challenge to the Affordable Care Act that the court decided 8-0 to send it back down to the lower courts to try to find an accommodation for these religious institutions. And so I do think he does try to find that consensus, and I don't think that's a bad thing, you know, I hope it continues even when there are nine of them. You know, why not try to get consensus even when there's nine?
Here's Stephen Breyer, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, speaking at the Library of Congress on May 23rd. He's downplaying the concerns about having an eight-member Supreme Court. Of the 70 to 80 cases the Supreme Court hears a year, he says, Justice Antonin Scalia's vote would have been significant in just a handful.
So I said, how many cases are there that Nino's vote would have made a difference? I think there were four or five.
Let's go to Andrew in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you.
Yes.
So what I think that having, I agree with Justice Breyer's statement that maybe not only four or five cases would have been that important, but those are four or five Supreme Court cases that could have used another opinion. I think that the appointment of Judge Garland being postponed so long as it has is also kind of unprecedented in a way and really without reason. I know that some commentary from politicians have been we need to wait to see for the next election, but we had an election in 08 and 2012 and the people voted. You know, I think at this point it has been decided, and we should be moving forward.
Andrew, thank you. Emily Bazelon, I mean, to Andrew's point about this being unprecedented, don't know the history of that necessarily, but it is a very real possibility that we could not have a new Supreme Court nominee until next year and that we might have a vacancy on the court for another full term?
That's possible. It really depends on who wins the next election and Congress's reaction. The blocking of Garland's nomination is unprecedented in the sense that we haven't seen before a nominee not get any kind of consideration, no hearing, no effort to have a vote and decide not to confirm him if that's what the majority of the Senate feels. But this idea of completely stonewalling and sidelining his nomination, that's the part that's new. And it is a kind of increasing of the an upping of the ante in this very already very contested Supreme Court nomination process that we unfortunately have.
Let's go to Phil in Iowa, in Renwick, Iowa. Hi, Phil. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, my point is, and that's not really a point, but just an inquiry. The law is the law. And it just seems like anymore with any of the high courts, instead of thinking about what is the law, it seems like their first thought seems to be, well, how would my Republican brethren vote? Or how would my Democratic brethren vote? And it just seems to me that that's wrong. They're supposed to disregard that. They're supposed to be above that when they reach that point in their careers.
Bill, now, thank granted, you. I hear your point, and I'm glad you called Brian Fitzpatrick. Do you have a response to that? You've clerked on the court. You have had a bird's eye view of what goes on over there, looking out. What do you see?
I'm very sympathetic to what Phil says. I will tell you that, and the problem is that the court has decided to constitutionalize issues that the Constitution says nothing about, and so. The jurisprudence can't be grounded in the text of the Constitution. It can't be grounded in the history of the Constitution. So what is it grounded in? It's just grounded in their own personal opinions. And so that's why the politics overlaps so well with their votes in many areas of the law, because they're really not doing constitutional law in abortion cases or really even, frankly, affirmative action cases. They're just doing what seems right to them.
Emily Bazelon, wrap up here. Another quick thoughts on another couple of cases that the Supreme Court ruled on. The Supreme Court upheld a federal law that bars people with domestic violence convictions from owning guns. Put that ruling into perspective for us.
Well, this is, you know, a relatively minor kind of gun restriction. And the court has signaled in the past that even though it is now recognizing that there is a right under the Second Amendment to own certain kinds of personal guns, that that does not mean that states and localities can't regulate them at all. So it was also significant that the court decided not to hear a challenge to Connecticut's new gun control law, which bans assault rifles. And I think what we're seeing here is some flexibility on the part of the court. Yes, we see an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. We recognize that constitutional history. But that doesn't go so far as to mean that states can't pass what the court views as reasonable regulation. And you can see that as the justices just imposing their own policy preferences in the way that Brian was talking about. Or you can see it as a kind of pragmatism in which the Constitution and some of its big phrases, which the court has to give meaning to, is open to a variety of interpretations. And one way to decide is to think about the impact that a particular law or a ruling will have and what kind of best guess the justices can make about how they're going to affect the people who live here in this country.
Brian Fitzpatrick, this case was also notable in part because Clarence Thomas asked a series of questions from the bench, which was the first time in 10 years he'd done so. Also notable because Sonia Sotomayor joined Justice Thomas in dissent in this case, Brian.
Well, perhaps the reason why Clarence Thomas was able to ask a question was that Scalia had died, and it left some time for the rest of the justices to get a word in edgewise. You know, Scalia usually dominated the oral arguments, and now with him gone, maybe the others can have their say. I was interested in Sotomayor's vote in that case. There was also a case where she voted with Chief Justice Roberts on a separation of powers matter involving assets owned by the Iranian government. And so she's something of perhaps a swing vote herself, and I find that very, very interesting, and I'll be curious to see how that plays out in the years to come.
Emily Bazelon, with all the cases that we've talked about today, the Texas abortion case, the most important, I guess, of this term, of this Supreme Court term?
It's really important, but the immigration ruling affects millions of people, so we need to take that into account as well, and as Brian said, that one will go another round.
Brian Fitzpatrick, professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School. Really appreciate your perspectives today, your time, Brian. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Emily, always great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And you can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.